This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Mississippi Trial 1955 by Chris Crow. Read for you by Victor Baveen.
Chapter 1. My dad hates hate. All my life, if the word ever slipped out of my mouth, he'd snap into me faster than a rattlesnake. "Hiram," he'd say, straightening up like a preacher. "The world's got plenty enough hate without you adding to it. I will not tolerate such language or even such thinking in my home or in my family." He'd go on with his sermon for too long, 5 minutes or more, preaching about the evils of hate and reminding me how hate had hurt folks back in our old home, the Mississippi Delta. Then he'd march me up to the bathroom and give my tongue a slathering of Lifebuoy soap. I can't tell you which was worse, the sermons or the soap, but I will tell you this. I hated Dad when he acted like that, like some kind of born-again crusader out to protect everybody's right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. By the time I turned 16 last July, I'd had it with Dad's sermons and weirdness about hate, racism, equal rights, and all that. Funny thing was, the more he preached about hate, the madder it made me. Never told him to his face, of course. It wouldn't have been worth it. But I let him know in 1,000 ways that I'd just as soon live in the Arizona desert with Gila monsters and tarantulas than spend any time with him. But a few months ago, the summer of 1955, lots of stuff happened. Stuff I never would have imagined. It was strange, but you know how sometimes when you get what you think you always wanted, it turns out to be nothing like you expected? That happened to me when I was back in Greenwood, Mississippi last summer. Some awful things happened to a Negro kid named Emmett Till, and I was right in the middle of it, smack in the heart of crazy, senseless hatred. And you know what? When it was all over, I started seeing Dad and lots of people a whole lot different than ever before. I first started butting heads with Dad in 1948. I was only 9. Because he dragged us away from Mississippi. Dad and his dad, Grandpa Hilburn, got along about as well as Hitler and Roosevelt. Spend any time with the two of them in the same room, and you'd figure that World War II hadn't ended yet. The problem was that while Dad was away fighting Japanese in the Pacific, and Mom was working for the war effort, Grandma and Grandpa Hilburn raised me. They spoiled me pretty good, I guess. But as a little kid, I liked the spoiling, and I loved my grandparents. And their big old house, and Greenwood, Mississippi. Dad came home from the war, took one look at how tight I was with Grandpa, another look at the South he hated, and used the GI Bill to go up to Ole Miss to get a master's degree in English, so he could land a college teaching job out west, far away from Grandpa, from Mississippi, from racism and prejudice, from hate. Mom and Dad lived in a shoebox-size apartment up there, so while Dad studied and Mom worked at Oxford Elementary School, they let me stay with Grandma and Grandpa for the 2 years it took Dad to finish school. Looking back on it now, I can see how lots of things that happened when I used to live in Greenwood stacked up to set the stage for all the horrible stuff that took place last summer. I still remember being a little kid in Greenwood. I spent nearly all my time with Grandpa, and we had a regular routine. After breakfast, we'd walk down to the LaFleur County Courthouse so Grandpa could do a little business. That usually meant he'd stroll into someone's office, pull up a chair, and visit. Usually, before he'd even sit down, he'd fish in his pocket for a nickel, hand it to me, and say, "Hiram, Mr. Harton and I have some serious business to tend to for the next little while. Why don't you run down to the lobby and see what Mr. Paul's got for sale today?" Funny how you remember some days more than others, but I still remember one summer morning there. With the nickel in my fist, I left Mr. Harden's office and headed straight for the glass cases and counters in the center hallway of the courthouse. Hey, Mr. Paul, it's me, Hiram Hilburn. Little Hiram, how's the world treating you this morning? Mr. Paul turned to face me, smiling with his hands flat on the glass countertops. He looked about my dad's age, and I know he'd been in the war, too. His army truck hit a landmine in France, and he ended up blind. Dark glasses hit his eyes. Grandpa gave me a nickel. That right. Nobody can say old Earl Hilburn doesn't know how to occupy his grandchild. What'll it be today, Hiram? I walked up to the glass display cases and looked over the rows of gum and candy bars laid out on the shelves. Behind the counter, Mr. Paul kept an ice chest full of soda, and on the right side of the display case, he kept a cooler filled with ice cream bars. It was a hard decision. I've got some cold Coca-Cola back here, he said, but I know you like those Eskimo pies, too. This particular morning was cooler than most summer mornings had been, so I had my eye on something else. Could I please have a Hershey's bar, Mr. Paul? Keeping his head upright, he reached carefully into the display case and felt around until his hand found the dark brown Hershey's bars. He set one on the counter. That'll be 5 cents. I snapped my nickel flat on the glass top. Mr. Paul felt for it, picked it up, and dropped it into the cigar box he kept on a shelf behind him. Pleasure doing business with you, Hiram. What big things do you and your grandpa have planned for today? Don't know, sir. I peeled the wrapper off my chocolate bar and broke off a section. He'll probably be talking in there with Mr. Harden for a while longer. Then we'll go out to the fields and work some before lunch. Mr. Paul grinned. Work? You mean your grandpa will drive out there and watch those boys sweating in his fields while he sits in his truck drinking lemonade and reading the paper? I'd surely like to get some of that kind of work for myself. A man approached the counter, and hearing him, Mr. Paul said, Well, I've got to get back to business. You have yourself a good day, Hiram, and stay out of the way of that busy grandpa of yours. I meandered down the marble hallway and out the main courthouse doors. A huge magnolia tree shaded the front of the building, and I walked under the tree and pulled myself up into its lowest branches, resting comfortably in a shady nook to enjoy my candy bar and wait for Grandpa. When Grandpa came out of the courthouse, we walked back home, got into his pickup, and drove north of Greenwood for a few miles on Old Money Road, past flat, wide fields furrowed with dark green cotton plants. Once we got to his fields, Grandpa parked the truck and turned me loose while he talked with the workers and looked over the crops. I wandered up and down the cotton rows, looking for arrowheads or lost tools or anything I could find in the furrows. Grandpa always rewarded me with a nickel when I found something. I liked exploring the rows of plants. They offered some shade from the Mississippi sun, and if the wind blew even a little, the plants swayed and stirred up air that seemed almost cool. When Grandpa was done in one part of the field, he'd whistle for me and we'd drive to the next section. The only person he ever talked to was the field boss, Mr. Irwin, a red-faced man who wore dark green coveralls. Grandpa talked to him, and then Mr. Irwin told the field hands whatever it was Grandpa wanted them to do. They were all colored men. I never saw a white man working Grandpa's fields. I hadn't found anything worth a nickel to Grandpa, so I followed some of the Negro workers into the rows while they chopped cotton. One man noticed me following behind and turned to talk to me.
You Mr. Hilburn's grandchild, ain't you?
I didn't answer. I was 7 years old, and he looked as old as Grandpa and taller. I'd hardly ever talked to a Negro man before, and I was scared. He smiled and patted me on the head.
It's okay, little Mr. Hilburn. I was wondering why you're following me.
His deep, gentle voice relaxed me. Just watching, I said cautiously. You're chopping those weeds pretty fast.
Got to, little man. This whole field needs chopping today, and if we don't finish it, it's going to be added to tomorrow's work. And if that happens, we ain't never going to go home tomorrow. And, son, I can't stand the thought of working in this field both day and night.
I can help. Sometimes I help Grandma in the garden. She says I'm a good worker.
Bet you are.
I bet you are. The man smiled and turned back to his hoeing. I stepped closer and could see the sweat damp on the back of his shirt. His black forearms, knotted with muscle, gripped the hoe, bringing it up and down rhythmically, knocking out weeds without hurting the cotton plants. I had to almost jog to keep up with him as he swept down the furrows. When we got to the end of the row, Grandpa saw us. The Negro worker paused a moment to stand up and stretch his back, and as he did so, I grabbed his hoe and headed back into the cotton.
Hiram! Hiram Hilburn, you put that down right now!
Grandpa shouted. I dropped the hoe and Grandpa turned on the worker.
You boy! He snapped. Don't you know any better than to let my grandchild play with that tool? I ain't paying you to be a slacker, so you've got no reason to be resting when you should be chopping.
The worker lowered his head.
Mr. Irwin know you take rests at the end of the row?
No, sir,
the man replied without looking up.
I catch you wasting my money again. You'll be working without a lunch break or not working at all. You understand me, boy?
Yes, sir,
the man said as he picked up the hoe and turned back to his work. Grandpa often got mad like that. Lightning quick, fast, and without warning. His voice changed completely. Mean. Mad and mean at the same time. It scared me.
Hiram, boy, you come here right now.
I trotted to his side, but stayed clear of his arm that tried to rest on my shoulders.
Son, let me tell you something.
He patted me on the head.
God made Negroes to work the land. They don't feel the heat like we do. They can work all day long in the most hellish weather. They're strong people, good with their hands.
I'm good with my hands too, Grandpa. Grandma lets me help in the garden.
Well, sure you're good with your hands, Hiram, but there's lots more that you can do. These folks, they're doing what the good Lord intended them to do. That don't mean you can't do it too, but you got more in you, boy. You're meant to be the boss, not the worker.
I looked out over the field at the black men. The backs of their shirts stained with sweat, bent over their hoes chopping weeds among the cotton plants. They worked methodically, quickly, almost like machines. I could do that, I thought, but I wouldn't want to do it all day. I followed Grandpa to the truck and climbed into the cab. He handed me a thermos cup of Grandma's cold lemonade. Hot from the time I'd spent in the sun, I gulped it down. No longer thinking about the black men and their back-breaking work out in Grandpa's fields. Chapter 2 Coffee. When I was at Grandma and Grandpa's house, I woke up every morning to the smell of coffee. The nutty aroma floated up the back stairs and into my room through the transom window above my door. Once I was awake, I tried to separate the other aromas of my grandparents' house. Some mornings, the meaty, spicy scent of sausage came up the stairs. Other days, the sweet fragrance of fresh muffins. Behind those morning smells lingered the mellow scent of mildew, wood, and ivory soap. To this day, if you dropped me blindfolded at my grandparents' home, I'd know I was there as soon as you opened the door. Grandma and Grandpa lived in a big white two-story house on Market Street, just a block from the Yazoo River and four blocks from the courthouse. Their house looks like a smaller version of the White House in Washington, D.C., without so many pillars in front, not nearly so tall and wide. It's the most comfortable place in the world. Grandma had a few wicker chairs out on the front porch and a porch swing to one side. When it was cool enough, we'd sit out there after dinner. But usually, Grandpa liked sitting in the living room in his big wingback chair, napping or reading the paper. I like the kitchen best. It's behind the dining room, and you can find your way there by following your nose. Grandma always seemed to have something baking. Biscuits, cornbread, cookies, cake, pies. If I wandered in, she'd tell me to sit at the kitchen table. While she found me something suitably sweet to tide you over till supper. And after she set a slice of pie or plate of cookies in front of me, She'd open the icebox and get me a cold drink of milk or lemonade. The kitchen was a small room with a large window over the sink that looks out onto the Remingtons' backyard. Grandma had a wooden table in the middle of the kitchen, where she did most of her cutting, kneading, and rolling. When it was just Grandma, Grandpa, and me for supper, we ate in the kitchen. When Mom or anyone else was there, Grandma insisted we eat proper in the dining room. My bedroom, Dad's old room, was directly above the kitchen. It had a squeaky old bed with four high corner posts and a wooden floor that creaked when I walked on it. If I lay quietly on the bed, I could usually hear the muffled clatter of stirring spoons, pots, and pans down in the kitchen. And of course, I could always smell what Grandma was cooking. Evenings, Grandpa would sit in the wide living room in the front of the house and read the Greenwood Commonwealth. He relied on the paper to keep up on the news of his old friends in the South, and especially in Greenwood, Mississippi. "Don't care much for the rest of the world," he told me once. "Didn't like Harlan going off to the Navy. American boys have no business fighting other people's wars. We've got our own way of doing things right here, and we've got our own problems to take care of. So it's no kettle of ours if commies or Nazis or anybody else wants to go killing each other. They can rot in Hades for all I care." I was used to Grandpa ranting about things in the paper, and I just kept quiet. I'd sit on the floor, looking over the last few days of the Greenwood Commonwealth, rereading Lil Abner and other comics I liked. From the kitchen came the sounds and smells of Grandma cooking. I could hear the sizzle of meat frying on the stove, and the open and close of the oven as she checked the biscuits or cornbread or pie or whatever she was baking for supper. One evening, Grandpa had been reading the paper for a while. Then he swore and snapped it down on the footstool in front of him. "Hiram, boy, I don't know what this country is coming to. Now the war's over, these damn Yankees are trying to tell us how to run the South. You're still little, but you remember this, son. Our way of life is precious. It's the way I live, the way my daddy lived, my granddaddy, and his daddy before him. It's going to be the way you live, too, if I have anything to say about it." I had no idea what he was talking about, but I didn't say anything because he had that mad look in his eye that he usually had when he argued with Dad. He went on about the South until Grandma called us in for supper. Grandma could tell Grandpa was stirred up about something when she sat down to eat. So before he could even start, she said, "Now, Earl, you remember our rule, no talking politics at the supper table." "Fine, Florence. I'll just hold all this frustration and nonsense in until tomorrow morning. But don't you go blaming me if I pop open and spray you all like a hot can of beer." His face flushed and he frowned. Then he looked at me and sighed. "I guess there's no need getting little Hiram all upset. Say the blessing, son, and let's plow into Grandma's supper. And Hiram, ask God Almighty if he might shed a little wisdom on them harebrained Yankees and their Mr. Harry Truman." After we finished supper, Grandpa went back to his paper in the living room, and Grandma started cleaning up. I helped carry the plates and things to the sink, but she shooed me out of the kitchen. "I do appreciate your help, Hiram, but I can manage just fine now. Why don't you go on outside and see if you can find R.C. somewhere?" R.C. Rydell lived way down River Road, along the Yazoo, in a dilapidated old house that he claimed had been in Greenwood since before the Civil War. At 9, he was 2 years older than me, but he was one of the few boys my age who always seemed to be outside the same time I was. That night, I swung open the back door and hopped down the steps into the yard. A faint breeze rustled the magnolia tree and azaleas in the backyard, and even though the sun had not yet set, outside was cooler than Grandma's kitchen. I pitched a rock at a stray cat prowling through our bushes. I missed it, but when the rock rustled through the branches, the gray cat dropped low to the ground, arched its back, and hissed. I launched another rock its way. "Hey, watch what you're doing!" R.C. stepped through the bushes and into our yard. He had on the same torn and oversized black high-top Keds he always wore. His shirt and jeans were rumpled and dirty, his red hair a tangled mess. He scowled at me like the cat had.
"You about put my eye out, Hiram. Ain't your granddaddy taught you about throwing rocks around people?"
"Sorry, R.C. I was trying to chase that old tomcat out of our yard. He gets into Grandma's garbage cans."
"Y'all want to be getting rid of a cat, you need a good BB gun, not a rock. A hot BB in the butt'll help that old cat remember to stay out of your yard. I'd borrow you mine, but you're too little to be handling a gun."
I've never seen R.C. with a BB gun, but I didn't question him. He always told more than he had. "So what were you doing up in those bushes?" I asked. "You find a nest or something?"
"Don't you know nothing, Hiram Hilburn? No bird with half a brain would build a nest in azalea bush. No, I was just in there so I could get a good look at the Remingtons. They's dancing again."
Ralph and Ronnie Remington lived behind our house. A couple of brothers who had never married. They lived alone in a southern mansion that probably used to be fancy, but was now run down and surrounded by weeds. R.C. said they were crazy. Grandpa said they were addle-brained but harmless. Grandma said they were two lonely old bachelors who drank too much. I'd never spoken to Ralph or Ronnie, even though I saw one or the other almost every day. Ralph looked older. His hair had streaks of gray, and he always had a worried look on his face when I'd see him hustling down the sidewalk from downtown with a narrow brown paper bag under his arm. He'd walk down River Road to his house. Then instead of going up the front steps and in the front door, he'd follow a path he'd worn in the grass around the side of the house to the back door. Ronnie was heavier than Ralph, and his dark hair covered only the sides of his head. Grandpa said he looked like a fat monk. He usually wore a baggy army uniform with no insignias.
"Likely he got that uniform from the Salvation Army shop," said Grandpa. "Because even the U.S. Army knows better than to let a knucklehead like Ronnie anywhere close to their business. If Ronnie Remington had been in the war, we'd all be speaking German and Japanese right now."
Sometimes I'd see Ronnie down at the courthouse carrying mail and papers from one office to another. Charity work, Grandpa called it. Neither of the Remingtons was allowed to drive, so Ronnie walked everywhere in town. He was slow and sort of ambled from one place to another, usually looking for people he knew so he could ask to borrow a nickel. Grandma said he spent all his money on ice cream and cookies. And I guess she was right, because when I saw him strolling home some afternoons, he usually had a small grocery sack clutched to his chest. When Ronnie got near the Remington house, he never walked up the front sidewalk. He had his own path worn through the grass and weeds. It angled from the corner of their yard to the front steps. Funny thing about the Remingtons, Ronnie would only use his path and enter through the front door. Ralph would only use his path and enter through the back.
"Shh," hissed R.C. "They's dancing, look."
He pointed through an opening in the azaleas that gave us a clear view through one of their back windows. Stripped down to their boxer shorts and tank top undershirts, Ronnie and Ralph waltzed by the window. Before R.C. started giggling, I could hear the faint strains of waltz music from their record player. They passed by again and did a slow, awkward turn in front of the window. While Ralph planted both feet, braced himself, and strained to keep his balance, Ronnie leaned back in a deep dip, letting his thick left arm swing wide and high, his pinky finger extended. Shaking with effort, Ralph managed to pull Ronnie out of the dip and continue their 1-2-3 around the room, and I swear I could hear their floor creaking and sagging. When they came by the window again, I could see Ronnie's sweating face framed in concentration, counting out the waltz steps while Ralph struggled to lead his fat younger brother around the room. They moved like two old cows up on their hind legs. R.C. could stand it no longer and fell to the ground, snorting and choking, trying to stifle his laughter.
"Oh my God," he sputtered. "Can you believe those two hippos dancing? They ought to put them in the county fair."
He laughed and snorted louder.
Quiet, R.C. Dang it, if they hear us, I'm going to be in big trouble with Grandma. You know she thinks we ought not bother Ralph and Ronnie. Quit being a sis, baby. We ain't doing nothing wrong. They's the weirdos dancing around in their underwear. Grandma says it's not our business what they do as long as they don't bother us. She told me I had to be neighborly and polite and stay out of their way. R.C. picked up a rock and moved through the azalea bushes toward the house. R.C., no! I hissed as loud as I dared. We're going to be in big trouble if you do. Crouched low and partially hidden by the evening's shadows, R.C. wound up and chucked his rock. It cracked against the house just above their window when they waltzed by again. Ralph stumbled and disappeared from view, while Ronnie looked pale and stunned for a moment before coming to the window. What's that? Who's there? You scat now and leave us be. Who's there? R.C., still hidden by shadows, let out a loud, low,
Moo-ah! Moo-ah! Moo-ah,
you old cows! And sprinted around their house and down River Road, laughing and mooing all the way. Who's there? Who's there? Called out Ronnie nervously. You just go on and leave us be. Just you scat, you, and leave us be. I ducked back through the bushes and into our yard. Sometimes I didn't like how R.C. played, even if he was older than me. It didn't seem funny at all when Ralph had looked hurtful, surprised, and Ronnie looked scared. I trudged up the back steps to the kitchen, hoping Grandma would offer me another slice of apple pie when I got inside. Maybe that'd get rid of the bad taste in my mouth. August. A month after my 8th birthday, Grandpa and I had been following our summer routine pretty faithfully. Some days, though, I'd stay home and go fishing with R.C. down on the Yazoo. He was a good fisherman, even though he always used a cane pole. I got a nice rod and reel down home, but my daddy don't want me using it without him around. Besides, I do just fine with this old cane pole. I bet those fish get scared just knowing I'm coming. I'd walk the 1 or 2 miles out to the edge of town to R.C.'s house, and from there we'd walk a couple miles farther down River Road, where the trees and brush cleared away from the riverbanks. Grandma would pack me up a lunch, food enough for 2 men. Grandma, I told her the first time she made the lunch, you know I don't get that hungry. I don't think I can eat all of this. Darling, you never know how hungry fishing might make you. I don't want to be worrying about my only grandson starving down there on the Yazoo. Believe me, it'll all get eaten. She wrapped 6 ginger snap cookies in wax paper and tucked them into the top of my lunch sack. When you get to the Rydell's house, you find that little girl Naomi and give these to her. Poor thing probably hasn't had a treat since Christmas. R.C.'s little sister, Naomi, was my age, but I never saw her in town except during the school year, and even then she only came once in a while. She always seemed skittish, kind of like a cat that's been kicked around too many times. I'd liked her from the first time I met her, and Grandma knew it. Grandma used to ask about her, if I'd seen her or how she looked, and when I'd hear her talking to Grandpa about Naomi, she always called her a poor little thing and would tell Grandpa, "It's a crime what's going on out there, Earl, a crime. Since that little girl's mother died, I don't think one nice thing has happened to her, and now she's being mother and daughter in that house." R.C. was waiting for me on his rickety front porch, and the first thing he noticed was the canvas lunch bag I had slung over my shoulder. "What you got there, Hiram?" "Grandma made me a lunch." "Granny made you a lunch? What a sis, baby. We ain't going camping, we're going fishing, and nobody takes no lunch on a little fishing trip. That big old bag's going to be in our way all day long." He reached for it. "Let me see what your granny packed." "These are for Naomi," I said as I pulled out the cookies and handed the bag to R.C. "She around?" "Naomi!" R.C. yelled. "Hey, Naomi, get yourself out here." He snatched the cookies out of my hand. "Your boyfriend brung you something." My face turned red. "I'm not her boyfriend, R.C., I said, even though I wished I was.
Grandma sent those for her. R.C. ignored me and waited for Naomi to open the front door. When she came out on the porch, she looked mad.
R.C., would you just shush up? Pa's still sleeping.
She had her hair in pigtails, as always, and wore the same faded flower sack dress I'd seen her in at school.
Hey, Hiram.
She smiled when she saw me, and I felt my face turn red again. Hey, Naomi. My grandma sent something for you. I pointed to the wax paper bundle R.C. held in one hand.
Sweets from your sweetie,
R.C. teased.
Ain't Hiram a regular old Romeo? Your other boyfriend's gonna be jealous they find out about this, Naomi.
Naomi walked down the front steps to R.C. and held out her hand. With anybody else, R.C. would have eaten the cookies himself, or crumbled them up, or tossed them on the roof. With Naomi, he handed them to her with a smile. Naomi unwrapped the cookies.
Gosh, Hiram, your granny sure is nice.
She took a big bite out of one and said with her mouth full,
Wish I could go fishing with y'all, but I got chores to do and then I got to fix lunch for Pa when he wakes up.
She wrapped the cookies in the wax paper and trotted up the porch steps.
Tell your granny thanks, Hiram,
she said before she went back inside the house.
And good luck fishing. I hope R.C. brings back some fish for supper.
I watched the door close behind her and wished I could have thought of something nice or clever to say to her. Instead, I just stood there like a post until R.C. punched me in the shoulder.
Come on, Romeo. We don't got all day for you to stand there gawking at my little sister.
We were barely back on the road in front of the Rydell's house before R.C. was rummaging through my lunch bag. I told Grandma I didn't need that much lunch, but she made me take it all.
Biscuits, still warm.
R.C. pulled out two, shoved one into his mouth, and slung the bag over his shoulder.
Let me haul this bundle for you, Hiram. We's walking a ways to get to the good fishing hole, and you're so little you'd get wore out carrying this load the whole way.
He ate the other biscuit and fished around inside the bag.
Sausage!
He pulled out a handful of dark brown sausage links.
This is good stuff, Hiram boy.
R.C. ate as we walked, stuffing himself with the loot Grandma had packed. When we were still a ways from our fishing hole, he belched and handed the half-empty bag back to me.
Your granny does know how to cook, Hiram, that's one thing, sure. You can carry this for a while.
By noon, we were both hungry, and we filled up on Grandma's sandwiches, thick slices of homemade bread with a slab of honey ham between them. The bottom of the sack held a dozen ginger snaps, which we finished off after the sandwiches were gone. We saved the two apples to eat on the way home. Though I loved spending time at the river, I never got any good at fishing. Most of the time, I'd pull up my line to see a bare hook stripped of its bait by a sneaky catfish. R.C. tried to show me how to tell if a fish was nibbling at my bait, but I never caught on. That old cane pole didn't slow R.C. down at all. He seemed to snag a fish at will. Every time he hooked one, he'd laugh and jerk it out of the river onto the shore, where he'd let it flap and flail on the ground. If it was too small, he'd snap it in the head with his finger to stun it, take it off his hook, and toss it back into the water.
Ain't worth my time, little fish, he'd say. You eat some more of Hiram's bait and work on growing. Maybe next year I'll come back and catch you for Naomi's frying pan.
The keepers he put on a stringer, a woven cord with a 3-inch nail tied to its end, anchored with a rock on the riverside. To add a fish to the stringer, R.C. would work the nail up through the fish's gills and pull it out of its mouth, then hammer the nail back in the ground with a rock and toss the fish into the water to keep them fresh until we went home. After lunch, R.C. got restless. He had a few keepers and didn't pay much attention to his fishing line after he cast it into the river. I enjoyed sitting there, full of Grandma's lunch, watching the thick green water flow past, hearing the locusts buzz in the brush around us, feeling the hot Mississippi sun on my back. R.C. didn't like silence. He wanted to talk, mostly about things I had no interest in.
Hiram, ain't them Remington brothers strange? Dancing round in their underwear? Dang, that sure is strange.
Maybe they were too hot.
Hot? Maybe they's fairies.
Huh?
Fairies. You know, queer. Pa thinks so.
I had no idea what R.C. was talking about. So I shut up and concentrated on my line in the water. Sometimes he could be pretty hard to take. R.C. turned back to his own pole and for a few minutes was quiet. But only for a few minutes.
Tried me some chewing tobacco last week. Pa said it'd make me sick, but it didn't. I chawed on that like a man, Pa said. You ever tried it?
No, my dad would kill me if he heard I'd been trying chew.
Sheesh, your daddy is the stickinest Pa I ever heard of. Seems like you can't do nothing fun, Hiram, except fish and go out to work on your granddaddy's fields. You're just plain no fun at all.
I have plenty of fun, R.C., you just don't...
Haw, you're the boringest kid I know. Bet you don't even have a girlfriend.
My face turned red. Except for Naomi, I never even talked to girls.
I got me one. Becky McCray. Last year, she liked me to walk her home from school. I seen her underwear, Hiram.
Who cares, I thought. R.C.'s stories were making me tired, and fortunately, a tug on his line distracted him for a moment. He jerked a smallish catfish onto the shore. It flopped and glistened in the sun, snapping its head and pointed stingers from side to side.
Hoo boy, this one's a little fighter.
R.C. stood out of the fish's way as it thrashed on the ground. When it quit flipping around, he stunned it and held it up.
Hey, Hiram, watch this.
R.C. held the catfish tight in his left hand and had the nail of his fish line in the other.
What you think's in his eyes?
He pressed the nail gently against the fish's eye. The fish jerked when the nail touched it, but R.C. held it firm. Gradually, he pressed harder and harder with the nail until it punctured the eye and clear fluid trickled out.
Shoot, no blood.
He took less time with its other eye, jabbing it with the nail, then working the point deep into the socket.
Hey, this little old catfish is just like Mr. Paul. Look at me, I can't see.
I felt like I was going to throw up, but I did nothing to stop R.C. He kept poking that fish until it flinched and snapped its stingers into R.C.'s hand.
Ow! Hell, damn it, this thing stung me!
He threw the fish to the ground and grabbed his hand.
Ow, 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 that burns!
He sucked the wound, then spit.
I hate catfish. Them stingers hurt worse than Pa's belt.
And he wasn't finished. He picked up the fish line nail, bent over the fish, and jabbed the nail into its side. Blood oozed out. R.C. jabbed it again and again until it was pockmarked with bloody holes. Then he threw the nail down and rested one ragged sneaker on the fish.
Look at Hiram, I'm gonna squash its guts out.
He stood on one leg, letting his full weight come down on it for a second before he slipped and fell. I couldn't stand it anymore, so I grabbed a stick and knocked the fish into the water.
Geez, R.C., what's the matter with you? Are you sick or something? What's the matter with you? It's only a stupid fish. It don't feel nothing. Dang, Hiram, you are one big sis baby getting all cryy over a dumb old fish. It's no good hurting a fish, R.C. It didn't do anything wrong. Stung me, didn't it?
He held up his hand. I had to teach it a lesson.
Fish don't learn lessons. They got no brains, R.C. They're just fish.
R.C. shook his head, looked over at the river and grinned.
Maybe so. But that dead catfish learned it sure won't sting me no more.
I tried to avoid fishing with R.C. after that. But it was hard to say no to him when he asked. Besides, I liked getting out on the Yazoo, and I wasn't sure what R.C. would do to me if I refused to go fishing with him sometime. I didn't want to end up like that fish. Chapter 3 Silence. One early fall morning a few weeks later, I woke up and the house was deathly quiet. The sun gleamed through my bedroom window. It was still morning, but something wasn't right. I sat up in bed and listened. I could hear the morning birds outside and the sound of cars crossing the bridge over on Fulton Street, but no sounds from the kitchen. No smell of coffee, bacon, sausage, and biscuits from downstairs. Maybe it's earlier than it seems, I thought. I slid out of bed and padded down the back stairs to the kitchen. No coffee brewed on the stove. Everything was exactly as neat and clean as Grandma had left it when I went to bed the night before. Grandma? My voice echoed softly in the kitchen. Grandma, you here? I walked through the dining room to the double doors that led to Grandma and Grandpa's bedroom. The door was ajar, and I nudged it open further with my head as I peered into their room. No one was there. It hadn't ever looked quite the way I saw it then. The sheets were wrinkled and shoved to the foot of the bed. A closet door stood open, and several drawers of Grandpa's dresser stuck out. A chair in the corner had been tipped over. The room felt completely empty. Grandpa? Grandma? It felt strange to be in the house alone. I wasn't afraid, it just didn't seem regular. I walked back to the kitchen to get something to eat when I heard the front door open. Hiram? Hiram, boy, you back there? Grandpa came into the kitchen wearing his bib overalls over his pajamas. His hair was rumpled, and he looked exhausted, more tired, more beaten than I'd ever seen him. He walked in just as I was about to take a bite of the ginger snap I had pulled out of the cookie jar, and I was afraid I was going to catch it from him for eating a cookie first thing in the morning. Sorry, Grandpa, but I couldn't find Grandma and didn't know what to eat. Come here, son. Come here. He reached his arms out to me, and his eyes welled up with tears. At first, I didn't recognize the look on his face. He wasn't mad, that I knew. A tear trickled down his cheek. Come here, son. Please come, let me hug you. His voice quivered. He wasn't mad at me. He was sad. I ran to him and buried my face in the bib of his overalls. He held me tight and said, Oh, Hiram, son, she's gone. What am I going to do? She'll be back, Grandpa, I said as gently as I could. I bet she just went up to Oxford to see Dad and Mom. We can eat breakfast at the River Cafe, and then you can take me to school. We'll be okay. Grandpa sat down at the kitchen table and pulled me into his lap. No, son, Grandma's not coming back. Not till the good Lord brings her home to us. His eyes were watery and red. She's gone to glory, Hiram, gone to glory and left me here alone. Oh, what am I going to do? Then it hit me. Grandma was dead. I wrapped my arms around Grandpa's neck and hugged him while we cried together, mourning the loss of a wife and grandmother and friend, wondering how we could possibly survive without her. Dad and Mom came down to Greenwood as soon as they heard about Grandma. They stayed for the funeral, and those days were the only times I had seen Dad and Grandpa together without fighting. Maybe it was out of respect for Grandma, or maybe they just didn't have time. I'd never been around anyone's dying before, and I was surprised at how busy the house got. Neighbors brought in food and flowers. Often they stayed late into the night, eating and talking with Grandpa and Dad about Grandma. Mom and some neighbor women stayed busy in the kitchen, keeping food coming out into the dining room, washing dishes and finding space for the plates of sliced ham and roast beef, the bowls of potato salad, the peach pies and chocolate cakes, and the loaves of bread that people brought over.
Ralph and Ronnie Remington even came over to pay their respects. Ronnie wore a black suit coat stretched to button across his wide belly. A limp bow tie hung cockeyed from the collar of his white shirt. Ralph wore a blue tuxedo jacket with navy blue pants, shiny at the knees. He carried a champagne bottle with a wide purple bow tied around its neck. Both men looked about as comfortable as cows in a slaughterhouse. The two of them were speaking quickly to each other, their gaze darting around the room at the neighbors who avoided or ignored them. Ronnie kept wiping his forehead with a gray handkerchief while Ralph steered him through the crowded living room toward Grandpa and Dad. A group of friends and neighbors stood around my dad and Grandpa, and when they saw the Remingtons approaching, they closed ranks, blocking them from the circle of mourners. Ronnie looked panicked, mopping his forehead faster and faster while whispering to Ralph. Ralph nodded and listened with a hand on his brother's arm to keep him from bolting. I watched him scan the room, looking for an out, hoping to make contact with at least one person. I gulped when his eyes met mine, and he immediately smiled and walked toward me, pulling Ronnie along. Ronnie kept his head down, glancing nervously from side to side.
"Young Mr. Hilburn, I presume," said Ralph.
"My brother and I, good friends and neighbors of your dear, dear grandmother, are heartbroken at this recent tragedy. Florence, your grandmother, was a champion, you know. Well, of course you know. A friend to all who knew her. A kind, gentle lady. Please know that you have our most mournful condolences." He handed the champagne bottle to me and nudged Ronnie in the ribs. Ronnie glanced at me before lowering his head again. He was crying.
"I promised Ralph I wouldn't cry. I did say it. Yes, I did. Ralph, I said I will not cry. No, I won't. Even though..."
His voice quivered.
"Even though Florence Hilburn was our best friend in Greenwood. Of course, Ralph won't cry. He's a rock, a real Gibraltar. Though if you ask me, a little emotion is a healthy thing once in a while. Some people are just so hard-hearted, you wonder if they have a heart at all. Not that I mean that Ralph is hard-hearted. No, I would never say that. But of course not your sweet grandmother. No, not her. Florence Hilburn was... she was a queen of kindness. Yes, I like how that sounds. It suits her. A queen of kindness."
He smiled and wiped a tear from his cheek with the back of his hand.
"Do you know that she often brought us dinner? Leftovers is what she called it, but it was a feast. That woman could cook, but she was full of charity, looked out for Ralph and me. Not that we can't look out for each other, for ourselves, of course. We're two grown men perfectly capable of taking care of ourselves, and never once did we look for a handout. No, sir, we never looked for someone's charity. Ralph, you know, isn't much interested in cooking, or eating for that matter, but I can get into the kitchen and put together a meal when I have to. Why, just last night I was frying some eggs to go with toast. A good meal, you know, fried eggs and toast, and we were about to sit down to eat."
His voice grew soft and quivery again.
"Well, anyway, Florence Hilburn was, oh, yes, she was, a queen of kindness."
Tears dripped onto his shoes. I felt sorry for Ronnie, and for me. Seeing him so sad made me miss Grandma more than ever. Ronnie looked wrung out from talking about Grandma, but Ralph was ready to move.
Well, yes, young Mr. Hilburn, by the way, what is your name, lad?"
"Hiram."
"Of course, Hiram Hilburn. How could I forget that? Many times I've seen you with your grandparents. Noble family you have here, young Harlan."
"Excuse me, Mr. Remington, but I'm Hiram. Harlan's my dad."
"Yes, of course he is. I've known young Harlan for many years, don't you know?"
He looked around him.
"It's clear that your father and grandfather are going to be occupied for some time with all these dear, dear friends. I'm afraid that I really must get Ronnie back home. This has been so shattering for him, so very difficult. Please extend our most severe and kindest sympathy to your family. I apologize for Ronnie's unseemly outpouring of emotion, but your grandmother's demise has come as a real shock to him, and of course to me as well. Ralph cleared his throat. Now we must return to our own abode and deal with our private grief in whatever ways seem to bring us peace.
Ralph nodded at me and steered the crying Ronnie back through the living room and out the front door. When they left, I realized I'd been crying too. The graveyard ceremony was just as depressing as everything else had been. Watching Grandma's coffin get lowered into that grave just about broke me in half. I can't recall anything the minister said. I felt like my ears were plugged and I was watching everything through watery eyes. After Grandma had been laid to rest, all the friends and neighbors stuck around to talk with Grandpa and Dad, and I just wanted to get out of there. So I told Mom I was going back to the car to wait for everyone. She understood, I think, why I needed to go. When I turned to leave, I saw Naomi Rydell. Her blonde hair was pulled into tight pigtails, and her face looked shiny and freshly scrubbed. "Hey, Hiram," she said. "Hey, Naomi. I didn't know you were here. I come a little late, and all those people were so crowded around I just stayed back a ways." She looked sad. "Don't like funerals." "Me neither. But I was glad to see her. She didn't make me feel any less sorry for my grandma's death. Being around her just made me feel better. Last funeral I went to was Ma's. Pa wasn't even there, just me and R.C. It was the hardest thing I ever done, and I didn't want to go. But I went anyway because I loved her and wanted her to know that without a doubt." "Funerals don't help a whole lot," I said. Naomi nodded and bit her lower lip.